Okay. Tov. If anyone needs more sheets, everyone has a sheet? Okay. So, today what we're going to discuss, the topic of the class is leaving the Egypt of the self. Leaving the Egypt of the self is a title which could be, in the beginning, sound to be very depressing or negative. Leaving the Egypt of the self, we don't like to look at ourselves as an Egypt. What would that possibly mean when we speak about the Egypt of the self? So the easy thing would be to say that we all have those issues that we deal with, those things about us that we would like to leave, those aspects of ourselves that we would like to leave. So one might think that leaving the Egypt of the self would be to leave, to be able to be liberated from those things holding us back, from those parts of ourselves that we wish we didn't have to hang on to, from the traumas of the past, from the bad habits of the past, etc. But the truth is that the mystics and philosophers spoke not about leaving those aspects of the self that we don't like, but even deeper, leaving the self, period. Leaving the self. Being able to somehow transcend and surmount one's self. And that's a very hard thing to grasp. What does that mean? Like, well, what could that mean to leave oneself? I mean, if you leave yourself, what else are you going to be? It's like Woody Allen has a line that he went to a therapist and the therapist said to him that, you know, you're not in touch with your real self. So Woody Allen's like, okay. And the therapist said, you know, come to my office once every week, you know, $180 for 45 minutes. And I'll help you find your real self. And Woody Allen said, I did that for about 7-8 years. And finally, you know, the therapist's like, okay, you found your real self. And he gave me the bill. And I said, give it to the person that I used to be. I mean, I'm somebody different. So when the mystics and the philosophers spoke of leaving the self, the Egypt of the self, so it's something more than just particulars. There's something a lot more radical. There's something a lot more fundamental. And there's something a lot more encompassing when we speak about the idea of leaving the self, of being able to transcend oneself. So I want to begin today the same way that we began yesterday, actually, by reading a poem of Rav Kook. Yesterday we actually read a piece from Rav Kook, which has his poetic style, but today I want to begin with reading a poem from Rav Kook. We're going to be discussing today both from Hasidic masters and from philosophers, to sort of compare and contrast the different ways of what that means, what could it possibly mean to leave oneself. And I always feel that when we're discussing topics that are not necessarily only cognitive, when we're discussing topics that are not only cerebral, when we're discussing topics that touch on the ineffable, when we're discussing topics that are somehow above our regular frame of reference, there's a beauty to poetry and song, and art. There's a certain power to these aesthetic evocations that allow us to be able to talk about and, so to speak, touch things that can't really be put into regular prose. You know, life is not prosaic. Life isn't prose. Life is something more miraculous and magical to life. And we all know that. And that's why, again and again, we always seek music and poetry and art. We seek these forms of expression because we always feel that words are inadequate and can't really give expression to things that are deeper than we're able to really quantify in words and stuff. Which is why I hate science. Because science, I mean, even though, again, science is important and stuff, but science is very much about quantifying. Science is very much about, you know, boxing things in. And there's an importance to that. I mean, if without science, we wouldn't be sitting in this building right here. And without science, we wouldn't have cell phones and cars and lots and health. So I'm not saying you don't need science. But sometimes when your soul feels that it wants to soar a little, in those times, those parts of the day when we want to go a little beyond what we're used to, so that's when we need poetry and song and art, etc. I know, I'm just going to say, my one of my all-time favorite movies, and I'd say it's probably one of the most greatest forces in my life that really was so meaningful to me. It's one of the things that really made me decide to be a teacher, was a movie called Dead Poets Society with Robin Williams, Zecheinu Levracha. I remember when I heard that Robin Williams, that he died and how he died. I was devastated for a very long time, for quite a few days. And I actually spoke about him in shul that Shabbos, and it was very tragic. I'm sure a lot of people felt very pained by that, by how he died, etc., and how he lived. That showed us how he lived. But that movie, I mean, he was a special person, and that movie, he really inspired me what it means to be a teacher. And one of the many lines in that movie, I highly recommend to everyone to see that movie, and then to approach Torah the way he approached poetry. One of the lines that he says in the movie is that, you know, medicine and economics and science, these are things that sustain life. Poetry is life. Poetry is what it means to live. So a poetic look at the Torah, a poetic meta-cognitive, beyond cognitive, beyond intellectual approach to Torah, poetic approach to Torah, to God, etc., that is the Eitz Chaim Hilamachzikim Ba. That's why the Torah is, that's how the Torah is a tree of life. And you know that at the very end of the book of Deuteronomy, who could tell me, what's the 613th commandment in the Torah? To write a Torah scroll. We're all commanded to write a Torah scroll. If we don't know how to do that, to at least give a little money towards it, etc. And anyone know what the words in the Torah uses for the commandment to write a Torah scroll? Anyone remember the verse? Ve'ata kitvu lachem. Anyone? Et ha'shira hazot. And now you shall write this song. And ve'ata kitvu lachem et ha'shira hazot. Now you shall write this song. And from there we learn you have to write a Torah. And that means that Torah itself is a song. All of Torah is really a song, is one long poem, because it's trying to evoke images and ideas and feelings, etc., and inspiration that's not just cognitive. And the Judaism that people run away from is the Judaism that just seems to be cognitive, intellectual, and dry, and not the Judaism that has the poetry and the song. And that's what we try to pursue. We try to look for that. We try to find that. And therefore, it's always important to focus on the poetry from tzaddikim, from those righteous people that were able to show us how to sing the song of Torah. So we're going to read this poem from Rav Kook. If it's okay with you, we're going to read it twice. We'll read it first faster. We'll go through it. Then we'll go through it again slowly. And then we're going to really spend the rest of the next hour understanding what Rav Kook is trying to say and how he's singing the song of what it means to transcend the self, leaving the self, and what that could mean for us. So look at the poem. Now it's a little cut off. I see in your copy it's cut off. On the top where it's written, I wrote Harav Kook Zatzal. And the name of the poem is, in Hebrew, this is a translation, he wrote in Hebrew. The poem is called, Merchavim, Merchavim, Kel Ivta Nafshi. Which is the first words of the poem. Merchavim, Merchavei, Kel Ivta Nafshi. Let's read it inside. Does anyone need a sheet? There are more sheets here if anyone needs. Could you pass them back?
Rav Kook wrote a lot of poems?
Yes, he did. Rav Kook wrote a lot of poetry. I mentioned... I'm sorry? What'd you say?
You just have an English, right?
Yes, I don't have the Hebrew on me. He wrote a lot. I mentioned yesterday that not only did he write a lot of poetry, he was adamant that for the preparation for Mashiach, this last generation before Mashiach comes, he very much encouraged all Jews to write poetry and to engage in art. In fact, Rav Kook opened up in Jerusalem, there's a school of art called Bezalel, which was Rav Kook's idea. Rav Kook wanted there to be art by Jews, etc. He very much felt that the exile forced us to stifle the aesthetic impulse. The 2,000 years of Jewish, you know, the shtetl living and that type of living sort of made us stifle that aesthetic impulse. And Rav Kook very much believed that we have to express that. It's interesting also, I'll tell you an interesting thing. The Lubavitcher Rebbe of blessed memory was not wont to leave 770. He didn't go on trips and stuff in 40 years. One of the few times he ever left 770 in the middle of a day, if you ever heard of the artist Baruch Nachshon,
yeah.
Baruch Nachshon artist, he lives in Hebron. He was also inspired by Rav Kook. And he brought an exhibition of art to New York. And the Rebbe went to see his art. There are pictures of him going around to see his art. He also very much encouraged Agam. Agam was by the Rebbe a few times, Rabbi Yaakov Agam, and the Rebbe encouraged him, etc. So there's definitely a necessity to bring back that loving feeling. that aesthetic impulse that Jews need to have. Okay, so let's see the poem, look inside. I'm going to read it first quickly, and then we'll read it again slowly. Expanses, expanses, expanses divine my soul craves. Confine me not in cages of substance or of spirit. My soul soars the expanses of the heavens. Walls of heart and walls of deed will not contain it. Morality, logic, custom, my soul soars above these, above all that bears a name, above delight, above every delight and beauty, above all that is exalted and ethereal. I am lovesick, I thirst for God, as a deer for water brooks. Alas, who can describe my pain? Who will be a violin to express the songs of my grief? Who will voice my bitterness, the pain of seeking utterance? I thirst for truth, not a conception of truth, for I ride on its heights. I am wholly absorbed by truth. I am wholly pained by the anguish of expression. How can I utter the great truth that fills my whole heart? I am bound to the world. All creatures, all people are my friends. Many parts of my soul are entwined with them, but how can I share with them my light? Whatever I say only covers my vision, dulls my light. Great is my pain and great my anguish. Oh my God, be a help in my trouble. Find for me the graces of expression. Grant me language and the gift of utterance. I shall declare before the multitudes my fragments of your truth, oh my God. So this, if you noticed already, we're going to read it again slowly, but it's an incredible poem, because essentially what Rav Kook is saying is that there's nothing, not only in the world, but there's nothing in, and here I'm putting quotation marks, religion that could satisfy his thirst. Right? Rav Kook is saying that there's nothing, that he has this painful anguish, this thirst that he can't express, which there nothing is able to satisfy. Did anyone catch what is it he's thirsting for? What's the one thing he is thirsting for that's beyond religion, beyond morality, ethics, law?
Truth.
Truth. Truth. Let's read it again. I'm sorry?
Like
who?
Tehillim.
Like what?
Tehillim.
I mean, the way he writes is poetic, so it could evoke Tehillim. But the poet that I would say, there's one poet in particular that I felt I was reading when I was reading this. That's it, Walt Whitman. To me, this sounds like Walt Whitman. And there are a lot of poems in Rav Kook that are very much like Uncle Walt. And there are a lot of themes in Rav Kook that are very much parallel to Walt Whitman. And we're going to discuss today that there was something in Rav Kook that was very similar to Walt Whitman. But of course, the difference will be that it's very much connected with God. But let's see the... But we have our youngest attendant of the shir. So he agrees. So there's something about Rav Kook that was very connected to Walt Whitman. I don't know if you know historically, but Rav Kook was a very controversial figure. And I'm not going to get into the whole story, but he had a very hard time from the quote-unquote old Yishuv, which was the Orthodox establishment at the time. And they very much were antagonistic to a lot of his ideology, and biographically, and a lot of the things that he wrote. And one of the things, let's say the Ger Rebbe, if you know the Ger Rebbe at that time, between the world wars, was known as the Imre Emes. And the Ger Rebbe expressed and he said that the reason he didn't agree with a lot of what Rav Kook was practicing and was teaching, and the way that the Ger Rebbe expressed it, is that the reason that Rav Kook is saying these things that were getting the other Orthodox establishment so nervous is... Sorry. The reason that Rav Kook is saying these things that was getting the Orthodox establishment so nervous is because the Ger Rebbe said he had such a big heart. His heart was so big that it couldn't be reined in, it couldn't be controlled by what they saw as Orthodox tradition. That Rav Kook's heart, so to speak, was too big too big for the tradition. Now, whether you agree with that or not, you know, whether he went, I personally don't think he went against tradition, but however you say that, but one thing for sure is that Rav Kook had a heart like Walt Whitman. And that's why I think a lot of the themes that they say very much parallel. Let's read the poem again together. Expanses, expanses, expanses divine my soul craves. Now, right away, that gives you, that's supposed to evoke a feeling of being, well, wanting freedom, being in a straitjacket, right? Expanses divine my soul craves. It means it's supposed to evoke a feeling that I am in Mitzrayim. I don't have freedom. I'm in a straitjacket. I'm in a narrow place, and I need expanses. So now most people, you would think if you just read that first sentence, like you think the guy's like in solitary confinement or something, right? Like you remember Papillon, you know, one of these, you know, or Steve McQueen with the Great Escape with the, remember Steve McQueen, the Great Escape with the ball, bouncing the ball, right? It evokes like this feeling of being like in this really dark and narrow chamber. But then he goes on to say, confine me not in cages of substance or of spirit. Now this right away is supposed to open our eyes because we could understand cages of substance. Most philosophers and mystics were striving to leave cages of substance. Substance meaning physical material. But what does it mean that he's saying, confine me not in cages of spirit? So that's already, that's the first thing that, he doesn't want to be confined in cages of spirit. My soul soars the expanses of the heavens. Meaning that the heavens, then I'm not looking for the heavens. Forget about not being in a physical cage. The heavens are also not enough for me. My soul soars the expanses of the heavens. I'm going beyond the heavens. Walls of heart and walls of deed will not contain it. Now, what does he mean, walls of deed will not contain it? Huh? Chesed or any mitzvah, seemingly. Seemingly, Judaism is a mitzvah about deed, right? About deeds, actions. And then there's heart. There's the feelings of the heart. You know, the Christian stereotype of Judaism, right? The Christian stereotype, which of course we don't agree with, to say the least, but the Christians always stereotypically portray Christianity versus Judaism as religion of the heart versus religion of the law, right? The heart and grace and salvation against the law. And of course we don't agree because we know ula avdo b'chol levavchem, we very much serve God with emotions, and we do believe in emotions in Judaism. But Rav Kook is saying that neither the law or the heart will contain my soul, which is soaring. Look, he said, walls of heart and walls of deed will not contain it. And then he goes beyond that. Morality, logic, custom. Now, custom means minhagim. Morality and logic are pretty cool things. Pretty nifty. Morality, logic. Logic, he means any cognitive logic. So he's saying morality, logic, custom, my soul soars above these, above all that bears a name. In other words, anything you could quantify, anything that could be even given a name. Above delight, above every delight and beauty, above the all that is exalted and ethereal. So Rav Kook is saying, what's containing him? Which prison is he in?
Prison of self.
We're going to obviously say that prison of self, but that means that what is he feeling contained by? What is he feeling stifled by? Delight, every delight and beauty, all that is exalted and ethereal, seemingly very good and positive things. It's very hard. Right? He's saying all these things, all that is exalted and ethereal, all these things are also containing him. He feels prisoned by things that are exalted and ethereal. I'm sorry, I just, it's very hard to teach with the...
Yeah.
I wish he could be able to listen to the baby, but... I'm sorry. I feel bad. I am lovesick, he says, I am lovesick, I thirst for God as a deer water for brooks. In other words, he's saying God can't be captured by any of these things. Anything exalted, anything ethereal, by logic, morality. Now as Jews, we understand seemingly that these are all things that Judaism, that are part of Judaism, right? Morality, logic, law, custom, deed, heart. What else would you define Judaism? Now, the point that I'm trying to say is that Rav Kook seems to be writing a very iconoclastic poem. Rav Kook seems to be saying that everything that we understand Judaism to be is a cage. And if unless you think, well, then he would find solace in, you know, Mozart or Rembrandt, Rav Kook is saying, no, above all the delight and beauty, above all that is exalted and ethereal. I'm lovesick, I thirst for God. Meaning, God, in what he really is not expressed in any of these things. Any of these things are only rays, glimmers, glimpses of divine light, but not God himself. And Rav Kook is saying, I am lovesick, I thirst for God, as a deer for water brooks. Alas, who can describe my pain of wanting God, of not feeling content with all the things that we usually content ourselves? Who will be a violin to express the songs of my grief? Who will voice my bitterness, the pain of seeking utterance? Because you know that I thirst for truth, not a conception of truth. Now what does that mean? So what do you think he means, I thirst for truth, not... pure truth. And what's another name for pure truth? Emes. And what's another name for Emes? Hashem. God is Emes. God is truth. Right? God is truth. Hashem alikim Emes. You all know the Gemara says, the Gemara in Tractate Chulin says that Emes, truth, is another name of God. Emes, truth, is a name. Real truth is a synonym for God. Because let me ask anyone to define me. How do you define truth? Right, beautiful, exactly. That's an exact translation of truth. That for which there is nothing other than. Because obviously, right away, what's your name?
Rachel,
right away, caught it. It's not, obviously, you can't, some people in a narrow way would define truth as what's not a lie, which is obviously not right, right? And truth, seemingly, if there's a truth, and there are two opposite truths, and let's say two opposite ideas, right? All men are created equal, on the one hand, and then you'll have some people that feel that there are some people that are more talented than others. Which of these statements is right? They're both right. Right? So there are a lot of different types of truth, and then you end up getting arguments for all eternity. But obviously, the only absolute truth is that for which there is nothing else other than that. Which is why God is called truth. He's the ultimate truth. And therefore, as beautiful as a Mozart symphony could be, as beautiful as any ethereal exalted delight of art, of song, science, anything that you see as beautiful is still a certain expression and not yet ultimate truth. And that's where Rav Kook said he was longing for, and that's where his pain is coming from. I thirst for truth, not a conception of truth, for I ride on its heights. I'm wholly absorbed by truth. I'm wholly pained by the anguish of expression, because something that essential can't be expressed. You can't express something like that. How can I utter the great truth that fills my whole heart? I am bound to the world. All creatures, all people are my friends. Many parts of my soul are intertwined with them. Now this, of course, is very much like Whitman, like Walt Whitman. Walt Whitman also saw the beauty in everything. Walt Whitman saw the beauty and felt friendship and kinship with everything that exists, because his heart was like Rav Kook's heart. The difference is, ready for this? The difference is that Whitman never sought, necessarily never had that pain of seeking a transcendent entity, and Whitman was a lot more pantheistic in that he saw the God, the divine in the imminent, which Rav Kook has too, which is what we spoke about yesterday's class, which we'll touch again on Thursday. There is a truth in seeing the divine in the imminent. That's what we spoke about yesterday, and we'll again touch on Thursday, seeing God in the world. But then there's such a thing that Judaism says, which is what Torah is about, which is what God is that God really also transcends everything. And so Rav Kook has this love, as he says, I am bound to the world. All creatures, all people are my friends. My parts of my soul are intertwined with them. He felt that kinship with all of reality. And there are places where Rav Kook speaks about not just other people, but nature, the beauty of the world. You feel intertwined with. We spoke about yesterday from Martin Buber, feeling the presence in the here and now, in the I-thou relationship within nature, within the world. So he felt that too. But then he says, look what he says, but how can I share with them my light? Do you understand? How can I share with them my light? Because unlike Whitman that just had this feeling of the imminent, the pantheistic, Rav Kook sought this transcendent truth of God's essence. And so he wanted to connect that with the world around. And that was the pain of all the mystics, that they wanted to bring this transcendent truth down to here. Whatever I say only covers my vision, dulls my light, because when you have something that profound, it can't be expressed. Great is my pain and great my anguish. Oh my God, be a help in my trouble. Find for me the graces of expression. Grant me language and the gift of utterance. I shall declare before the multitudes my fragments of your truth, oh my God. So the question becomes, if the truth shall set us free, as a certain Tanaic sage said, if the truth shall set us free, and we need this truth, that's real freedom, how do we relate to a truth like this, that Rav Kook's pain? So the question is, if Rav Kook is seeking this truth, he wants to leave the Egypt of everything seemingly and come to the infinite, so what does that mean for people like us? When you read a poem like this, what could that mean to us? How could we possibly tap into this yearning for truth? What could it possibly mean in our lives? So look at the other side of the page. So obviously we understand we're not going to reach, I mean, maybe, I mean, at least I'm not, maybe some people in this room can, but I don't think we could set as a goal to reach that level of Rav Kook, that yearning. But there is, listen carefully, there is a certain aspect. Rav Kook is obviously writing this poem for us because he wants us to tap into the search for truth. There's a certain aspect of this truth, this infinite transcendent truth, that will set us free, that we can tap into. Could you just close the door? Right, there's a door open there. There is a certain aspect of this divine infinite truth that we can tap into. Again, we might not have that same pain in the same way, that Rav Kook, and we won't have that same unutterable anguish, but there's a certain level of truth that Rav Kook is speaking about that we should be able to tap into. So look at the other side of the page. So we're going to begin with the teaching of Rabbi Nachman of Breslov. The Sefer Likutei Maran, I'm sure many of you have heard of Rabbi Nachman of Breslov, was an extremely deep teacher. And let's learn this piece together. It's a very short piece from Likutei Maran. Hayom im bikolo tishmau. So this is from Tehillim, chapter 95. Hayom im bikolo tishmau. Today, if you listen to my voice. I don't know, where is that from? Hayom im bikolo tishmau. Today, if you listen to my voice. Does anyone ever see this verse before, what it relates, what the Gemara says about it? Today, if you will listen to my voice. Huh? What? Well, it says today choose, but this particular what's the word? Elocution. Hayom im bikolo tishmau. Today, if you will listen to my voice. Hayom, today, if you listen to my voice. So this if any of you, there's a very interesting piece of Gemara that Rav Nachman is certainly making reference to. The Gemara in Sanhedrin says that Rabbi Yirmiyah met Elijah the prophet. Rabbi Yirmiyah met Elijah, one of the sages from the Talmud, met Elijah the prophet and asked him, when is the Messiah coming? And Elijah the prophet responded, Hayom, today. And he was very excited, Rabbi Yirmiyah. But what do you think happened? The day passed and the Messiah didn't come. And he met him later on in the day, and he went over to Elijah the prophet, and he said, you said the Mashiach's coming Hayom. So Leo Navi responded, I meant Hayom im bikolo tishmo. I meant this verse. Hayom im bikolo tishmo. Today, if you will listen to his voice. Today, if you will listen to God's voice. Now, was that like a trick? Was that like a, you know, false advertising? What was he trying? Was he playing a game over here? I said, today, Hayom, he's going to come today. But then I really meant the small fine print is in because if you listen to his voice. Huh? So it could mean it could happen anytime, yes. But what Rav Nachman is going to say, listen carefully, you ready? Rav Nachman is going to say that if you listen to his voice, doesn't contradict that he's going to come today. Listen, if you listen to God's voice in a way of today. Hayom im bikolo tishmo. If you listen to God's voice in a way of today. If you live in such a way of today. What does that mean? So look inside. Ze klal gadol b'avodas Hashem. It's a very big rule in the service of God. Shelo yosim leneged einav kim oso hayom. Never put before you anything other this day. Never feel that there's anything before this day, today. Hein beisek parnasa v'tzarchuse. Whether it comes to making a living, whether it comes to parnasa, or anything that you need, or anything else, we always have an issue. Our problem isn't generally, most of us are not worried about what we're going to eat today. Most of us are not worried about that the bank account doesn't have enough money for today. Most of the things we're worried about is, of course, tomorrow, the future. So if Nachman says, a klal n'avodas Hashem is to live today. I mean, you could probably reference Dead Poets Society and say, seize the day. Right? That you should, to be, the klal god n'avodas Hashem is that there's just this day. Tzorich shalei yachshav miyom l'chaveiro. K'muvah b'sof. Could you tell them to stop? There's no one there?
No.
What is it?
Oh, downstairs.
Oh. Tzorich shalei yachshav miyom l'chaveiro. K'muvah b'sofam. One should not think from one day to another, as it's explained in the Sfarim. Not to think of another day. V'chein b'avodasi yizbaruch le'yosem l'neged einav. And so too, not just when it comes to physical parnasa, but when it comes to service of Hashem. Think about this day. In other words, when it comes to serving Hashem, I might think to myself, does it pay for me to serve God today? Does it pay me to go to shul today? I know I'm not going to go next week. I know I'm not going to go next month. Should I do the right thing today? I know this isn't going to last. I know you might have had that train of thought. I certainly have, right? What does it pay to do today the right thing? I know that tomorrow is not going to be the same. Says Rav Nachman, a klal, a big rule in serving Hashem is not to have that type of thinking. To seize the day, to live the day. To live the day whether it comes to parnasa, thank you. Whether it comes to serving Hashem, there's just this day. Kim osa yom boisa shahayom. There's just this day. Ki kshiroitzim, now listen to this. Kshiroitzim likonasa b'vaydis Hashem, when a person wants to connect to God. Nidmela adam ki'ilu hu masa kovet. It seems like there's a huge burden to carry. And we know that, how many times have we been afraid to start new ventures because it would just seem that there's so much to do? And of course, if we would just realize, you have to just do today what you need to do today. You live today. Don't look at the huge burden that there is. Because when it seems like I'm not able to carry this burden, I'm not going to be able to finish the entire Shas. Should I begin learning Gemara? Does it pay for me to even try to learn a page of the Talmud? Am I ever going to be able to finish the entire Talmud? No. Am I going to be able to go to shul every single day the rest of my life? No. So she's not here now. There was a certain person that said to me, a couple of days ago, she said, you'll just see me by Yizkor. You'll see me by Yizkor. You're not going to see, Rabbi, you're not going to see me till Yizkor. So, I like made a face, like, well, how come? She said, because I don't go to shul usually. So I didn't want to say, because, you know, I never met the person before, and I want to be one of those annoying rabbis that seems to be, you know, pedantic or trying, I'm not here to ruin people's Pesach. But I was just thinking, you have a shul like 10 steps away, so you don't go the whole year. Go once, you know, it doesn't hurt. But right away we're afraid to do things because it seems like it's going to be this huge burden. If I do it once, then I have to do it always. And I'm not going to be able to do it. The next thing I'm going to know, I'm going to have to, you know, be ultra-Orthodox and move to Jerusalem. If I go to shul more than once a year. You know what I'm saying? It just seems so much. Nobody's saying to do that. Live today. Seize the day. Says Rav Nachman, if you just would think that there's just this day. Hayom. There's just today. Lo yila masa klal. It won't be hard for you at all. V'gam shali, and then don't push it off to another day. Gam liyitchas ma miyom liyom. Lema mosay aska machras, but tomorrow I'll start. Tomorrow I will pray b'kavana. V'chetz b'zah shavetz ke'ein la'odim bo. Listen to these words. Tell me if this doesn't sound like a lot of the movements that are popular in today in mindfulness. Listen to these words. Ke'ein la'odim bo'olamo. A person does not have in their world kim oso hayom v'oso hashoshemid, but you have nothing except this day and this hour. There is no future. There is no past. There is just now. Ki yom hamochras hu oylam acher lagamri. Tomorrow is a completely different world. Hayom im bikolo tishmo. Hayom dafka v'havein. There's just today. That's what Eliyahu HaNavi meant to say to Rabbi Yirmiyah. If we will live redemption, he wasn't trying to fool him. When he asked him, when is Mashiach coming? He said, Hayom. And when Mashiach didn't come, he responded, oh, I meant Hayom in Bikol Tishmo. What was he saying? He meant to say, if we Jews would live in a way of Hayom, we would, the now, that right now, this is the reality we have, that brings redemption. Now again, remember we're trying to understand the redemption that Rav Kook spoke about in the poem. So Rabbi Nachman is teaching us that the first hint to understand that freedom, the truth that will set us free, is to understand to live in such a way that there is no other time except the now. Seize the day. Carpe diem. Seize the day. There's only now. There is no tomorrow. Serve God now. Learn a page of Talmud now. Open up a Jewish book now. What's going to be tomorrow? Doesn't matter. There's just now. And living in such a way is living redeemed. That's what Nachman is saying. That's what it means to live in a way of redemption. And so too when it comes to physical things. All my worries are about tomorrow or the next day. What's going to be? How am I going to retire? My mother, she should be well. Since she's in her 40s, she's already planning her retirement. And I remember, I'm going to have to retire in 20 years. I'm like, Ma, you have 25 years to retire, you know. But there's some people that already when they hit 40, they're already starting to plan their retirement. I have another year and a half, so maybe I should get nervous. But there are people that are planning their retirement already, right? And they're always going to, what's going to be, and I'm not saying not to. I mean, I'm not that I'm an insurance agent, and I'm not saying one shouldn't do that. And Rav Nachman is also not suggesting not to do that. Rav Nachman is not suggesting not to take measures to make sure one will be okay in the future. He means to say not to worry about it. The worry about it, that's what he was saying. Lo yosim le'ena erev, he says, what's the word he used? That lo yachshav, don't be worried about it. The worry about it, there's just today. That's number one. That's from Nachman of Breslov. Now look at the second thing on the sheet. I want to learn with you one line from the Talmud. Now, I don't have time to, we didn't have time to go through the whole piece, but this line, this is the Tractate Bechoros 8b. So I don't know if any of you ever heard, one of the most interesting passages of the Talmud is the debate between Rabbi Yeshua ben Chanina and the elders of Athens. It's a fascinating piece of Talmud. If you ever want to read something fascinating, to look up the elders of Athens and Rabbi Yeshua ben Chanina, how there was this debate. According to many opinions, the elder of Athens were the early Christian sects. And there's this debate that happened, this very long debate with their riddles going back and forth, these seemingly zany Dr. Seussian type of riddles, which the commentators go to great length to explain what they each mean, and each one that we could spend hours talking about each one. But I want to read with you just one of the riddles that they asked, one of the 15. The elders of Athens said to Rabbi Yeshua ben Chanina, "Where is the center of the world?" That was the riddle. He raised his finger and said to them, "Right here." That was his response. They asked him, "Where's the center of the world?" And he picked up his finger and he said, "Right here." So the Maharsha, who is one of the famous commentators on the Talmud, the Maharsha says, what's this debate? Because again, there are deep philosophical ideas going on here. So the Maharsha says, you have to understand, this was just a couple of decades after the temple was destroyed. This was the beginning of the diaspora. This is right after the second temple was destroyed. Approximately the year 200 CE. So the Maharsha said, they were saying to him, "You Jews, you yourselves say that the Temple Mount, Jerusalem, the Temple Mount, which UNESCO yesterday just declared, doesn't belong to us anymore, right? But we have the Jewish history, the Torah says, you Jews say that Vizeh Shar Shemayim, that Jacob already said in Genesis, that this, the Temple Mount, is the gate to heaven." So the elders of Athens were saying to Rabbi Yeshua, "Okay, when you Jews were in Israel and you had Jerusalem, then you could connect to God. But in the diaspora, there's now thousands of years that we're outside of Israel. For hundreds of years, we're in Connecticut and New York and Poland and California and even Staten Island. All these places outside, how are you going to connect to God then? Where is the center of the world? Jerusalem is the center of the world. How will you connect to God if you're not in that center point?" You ever see the book The Sacred and the Profane by Mircea Eliade, who was one of the great anthropologists of religion? Mircea Eliade, there's a book, The Sacred and the Profane, where he says that every religion, by definition, has to have what he calls the axis mundi, which in Latin means the center point, where there's a center point that connects us with God. And that's true, and we believe that also, and we're not going to get into the theology of why that's true. But basically, the elders of Athens are saying, you don't have that axis mundi anymore, you don't have the center point anymore. So Rabbi Yeshua responded, and he says, we do have a center point of the earth. You know where it is? Right here. And that means if any one of us would pick up their finger, it means right here is the center of the world. What does that mean? It means in space the same thing that Rav Nachman said in time. There's time and space. Reality is time and space, right? So the same thing that Rav Nachman was saying about time, that what's the most important moment of the year? Yeah. Yom Kippur, Tisha, Yom Kippur, Rosh Hashanah, now. If anyone asks you on the Jewish calendar, what's the most important moment to serve God? Right now. More than Yom Kippur. Right now. Unless it's Yom Kippur. But right now. Right now. That's the most important time to serve God. Right now. Hayom. Impiko Tishmo. So to Rabbi Yeshua was saying, you know what the center point of the earth, you know where the most important place to find God is? Right here. The here and now. And that's redemption. Because that's truth. And the truth will set you free. You understand? You're starting to understand? What's the truth of God? The here and now. That's where you find the divine. When he's not caged in anything particular. When he's not caged. Of course, we Judaism, going back to Rav Kook's poem, we believe in morality. We believe in logic. We believe in the spirit and substance and absolute beauty and delight and all these things that Rav Kook was talking about. But if you feel that you need any of those particular things to feel the divine, you're in a cage. I need beauty to find God. I need morality to find God. I need deeds, mitzvahs to find God. I need a shul to find God. I have a whole list of things I need to find God. That's called being in a cage. That's not truth. That's not freedom. Freedom is, what's the truth of God that Rav Kook is looking to soar the expanses divine my soul craves. The expanses of knowing that the greatest, deepest relationship to God is what? Right here and right now. Look at the bottom of the page. There's a quote that my wife sent to me a couple of months ago. Andrew Murray was a Protestant minister from South Africa. He was a very, very prolific author and a very beautiful author. Look at this quote from him. When I saw this quote sort of puts together what we've been reading until now. Humility. Because of all religions say we need humility. And of course you understand that truth and humility are connected. Truth and humility are connected. That's why Moses, it says, the reason that Moses was the most humble person on earth was why? Because he had the biggest revelation of truth. The more you see truth, the more humble one is. Humility is perfect quietness of heart. It is to expect nothing, to wonder at nothing that is done to me, to feel nothing done against me. It is to be at rest when nobody praises me and when I am blamed or despised. It is to have a blessed home in the Lord where I can go in and shut the door and kneel to my Father in secret, and I'm at peace as in a deep sea of calmness when all around and above is trouble. And that, of course, made me think of the ultimate symbol of our freedom, more than anything else, matzah. Matzah is humility. Of course, that's what all the Sfarim say, the biggest difference between unleavened bread and leavened bread, matzah and chametz, is that chametz rises, matzah does not, right? Matzah is not bound by time and space, because bread, so to speak, takes up more space. Bread takes time to leaven. Matzah is not within the boundaries of time. Matzah's humble, doesn't take up space. And so matzah is the ultimate symbol of humility, which would all the Sfarim say, the difference between matzah and chametz is humility and not having humility. And the secret of humility, look again what he's saying. Humility is a quietness of heart, to be at rest when nobody praises me, and when I am blamed or despised, to have a blessed home in the Lord, where I can go in and shut the door and kneel to my Father in secret, and I'm at peace as in a deep sea of calmness when all around and above is trouble. So he's saying that means to be able to kneel and have a blessed home in God, when and where? Everywhere and always, here and now, at every single moment. Let's understand. There's a fascinating teaching that's found in the Hasidic books of Chabad. Let's go to the world of Chabad now. In the books, the Sfarim of Chabad, and Chabad Chassidus it speaks about, you know that the culmination of the redemption from Egypt was the splitting of the Red Sea. Right? We left Egypt, but the Egyptians were still hot on our tail. When did we finally manage to get rid of the Egyptians? The final end is, which we're going to celebrate on the seventh day of Pesach. That's why we have another Yontiv coming up on Shabbos. When we actually went through the splitting of the Red Sea. Everyone knows that. Everyone remembers the scene with Charlton Heston. I think there's a new one I didn't see yet. But the splitting of the Red Sea. I remember, by the way, when I was a kid, we went to Universal Studios when they showed how they did that. You remember? Anyone ever did that? It's really interesting because today, like, technology is like everything is way beyond the special effects. But when I was a kid, wasn't that long ago, but like 25 years ago, we went to Universal Studios in California, or was it MGM, one of these places, and they showed how they did Splitting the Red Sea. It was like a huge, back then, it was like big special effects. You probably remember. It was like big special effects. So you remember how they did it? You don't know? They let in the water, they filmed the water going in, and then they just put it in reverse. That was like the big cha. that was like the big special effects back then, that they filmed the water going in, and then they just played it in reverse, and that's how they did the Splitting of the Red Sea. So anyway, so that, of course...
I'm sure a Jew invented that.
What?
I'm sure a Jew invented that.
What do you mean? It was Moses. What do you mean? So, if you look over there, in the Torah, when it speaks about the story of the splitting of the Red Sea, there's a certain couple of words that it says twice, which the custom of the Jewish people is to read in a special tune. Vayavayu b'nei Yisrael b'toich hayom, b'yabasha, v'amayim lehem choma, miminam, mismalam. And the water were for them walls on their right and on their left. And it says again, the Jewish people went into the dry land, v'amayim lehem choma, miminam, mismalam. And the water were for them walls on their right and on their left. So the Hasidic books say, what's the stress with the idea that the water was on their right and on their left? What's this? Why is the Torah stressing all the time that the water's on the right and the left? We get it. They went through the water. They went through the water. The water was like walls. Why does the Torah say so many times, miminam u mismalam, and the right and on the left?
Left and right.
Huh?
Left.
I mean, they let in Democrats too. I hear. It could be. So there's a midrash that says as follows. Listen to the words of the midrash and you tell me what you think this means, based on what we're learning, okay? The Midrash says, Miminam bischus tfila, umismoilam bischus, I'm sorry, Miminam bischus toira, umismoilam bischus tfila. The water was on the right side, means the schus of Torah, and on the left side with the schus of prayer. What do you think that means? That the water was on the right and the left means in the schus and the merit of Torah study and the merit of prayer. Why would one be right and one be left?
Because that's what comprises our religion.
It comprises, okay, it comprises Torah study and prayer. Okay, they're both different. They're not all that's in our religion, but you're right, they are in our religion. But what do you know, based on what you've studied about the idea of Torah study and prayer, are they similar? Are there similar movements of the soul? Well, here we're saying the right side is the Torah and the left side is prayer. But yes, generally water could represent prayer, could represent Torah, could represent God. But here we're saying that the focus is on the right side and the left side, not the water as much as the right side and the left side, which is Torah study and prayer. Mind and the heart. Very good, Rachel, right. Mind and the heart. Or in Kabbalistic language, chesed and gevura. In the world of Kabbalah, Kabbalistically, the right side means from above to below, means going towards the earth. And the left side is like, fire, which goes from below to above, which is ascending. The mind goes from above to below, which is the right side, which is Torah study. Torah study is understanding, logical. Right? You know, I'm sure many of you know, there are people that feel spiritual and can't stand learning the Gemara. You ever hear people like that? The spiritual people that can't, you can't relate, right? There's some people that feel very spiritual, but they can't stand learning the Talmud. Why? Because the Talmud and prayer, mystical prayer, are seemingly, you can't get bigger opposite directions. One is logical, cold, going down. The other one is prayer, going up, prayer of the heart, ascending up. So what's the Torah teaching us? That the completion of redemption was what? When you have both. When there's not one particular way that you serve God. In other words, you know that today everyone likes specialists. Right? You know, today they have specialist doctors. You know, today you have a doctor, he specializes in the left ankle. And then, you know, you have to go with your insurance, you have to go to a doctor, that this is a doctor that does the left ventricle of the heart, and this one is a doctor of the right kneecap, and that, you know, everything is specialist today. And you have to find the doctor that will be able to, you know, work with your nostril, you know, everyone has their specialist. So there's certain people that when it comes to God, or when it comes to religion, or when it comes to anything in life, this is who I am. This is me. This is who I define myself. Which really is another way of saying, this is who I caged myself into being. You could be moral, you could be ethical, you could be learn Torah or pray, but this is what, I can't do something that's not my nature. That's what Rav Kook is saying, that's being caged in. In other words, if I feel that my mood is based on my surroundings and my circumstances, whether I could connect to God or not is based on a whole bunch of situations, I'm not truly free. Because infinity is not a number. Infinity is a state of being. Ein Sof, infinity is not a particular number. Infinity is a way of being. It's a way of approaching the world. It's a way of approaching reality. Infinity means not being caged in anything particular. In being able to do the right and the left. Being able to ascend up to God through the heart. And being able to quantify God through the mind. And being able to feel God in the beautiful lake view of Isabella Friedman. And being able to feel God in a busy street in Manhattan. Not being caged in any particular way of being. That's how you touch God's infinity. Meaning, when and where?
Anywhere.
Everywhere. And anytime, here and now, that's freedom. That's the humility. That's the quietness of the heart. Do you understand? That's what it means to have quietness of the heart. I want to talk about some of the philosophers and contrast what we've been speaking about. One of the greatest philosophers, in my opinion, that ever existed was Kierkegaard. And Kierkegaard, Søren Kierkegaard, who is considered the father of existentialism, has a whole book called The Concept of Anxiety. Now, when I tell you the title, The Concept of Anxiety, how does that make you feel? Doesn't seem to me, you don't want to read it, right? It seems to be a very terrible sound. But Kierkegaard's opinion is that the human condition, you're either in a state of anxiety or despair. That's your choices. You're either in a state of anxiety or despair. And Kierkegaard believes in his philosophy, that's his existential philosophy, most people are in a state of despair. And he has a whole book called The Sickness Unto Death, where he describes that state of despair, where he speaks about the fact that most of us were such in a state of despair that that's why we don't even feel that we're in a state of despair. We're so despaired of what it means... We're so despaired of what it truly means to be human and what it truly means to be free. We're in such a state of despair that we don't even feel it. And therefore, according to Kierkegaard, the only way to really reach freedom is through anxiety.
The opposite.
I'm sorry? What do you mean the opposite?
Despair and anxiety. Are they opposites?
Yes, they're opposites. We're going to discuss why they're opposites. Yes. Kierkegaard's belief is that the only way to truly be human and free is to be in a state of anxiety. Now, lest you think that sounds a little weird, because none of who wants to be in anxiety, ever heard of the psychologist Rollo May? Rollo May was one of the greatest 20th century psychologists, and I highly recommend looking at his books. He has a whole book called The Meaning of Anxiety, which is essentially an interpretation of Kierkegaard's concept of anxiety, and he speaks about how anxiety is so important to function as a healthy human being. So let's explain what anxiety means according to Kierkegaard. I want to read you a couple of quotes to put it into perspective. So I'm going to go around. I didn't make copies. I'm just going to jump around. But listen to a few lines. It'll give you an idea of what Kierkegaard means, the concept of anxiety. Anxiety is freedom's actuality as the possibility of possibility. Again, remember we're talking about freedom today. Anxiety is freedom's actuality as the possibility of possibility. What do you think that means? Freedom's anxiety, actuality, as the possibility of possibility.
Vision into this world, which makes you very
What's the pressure?
The pressure is I have to do it now. It's overwhelming.
What do I have to do now?
Make choices.
Make choices. The possibility of possibility means I could live. There are two types of way I could live life. Despair, which means not try to be myself, not try to make choices and be free, and just do what everyone else does. Or I could have the anxiety of the possibility of possibility. Listen to this quote. Anxiety may be compared with dizziness. He whose eye happens to look down into the yawning abyss becomes dizzy. But what is the reason for this? It is just as much in his own eye as in the abyss, for suppose he had not looked down. In other words, if dizziness comes from looking at the abyss, what brings that dizziness? The abyss? The fact that you looked at the abyss. Anxiety is that same dizziness. In other words, what makes you anxious? Not possibility, not the fact that we're free and free, that we have freedom of possibility of choices, but rather what brings the anxiety? Looking at that freedom. Do you understand? Should I say it again? If dizziness comes not from an abyss, but from looking down at the abyss, anxiety is the same thing. Anxiety doesn't come from the freedom of possibility. It comes from being aware of it. In other words, not being in despair and closing your eyes to it. Hence, anxiety is the dizziness of freedom. You hear that? Anxiety is the dizziness of freedom. Pesach is all about celebrating freedom, right? So Kierkegaard is saying there's the dizziness of freedom, which emerges when the spirit wants to posit the synthesis and freedom looks down into its own possibility, laying hold of finiteness to support itself. Freedom succumbs in this dizziness. In other words, being paralyzed by possibility, right? If one looks at what freedom really entails, one gets dizzy. This is an adventure that every human being must go through. To learn to be anxious in order that he may not perish either by never having been in anxiety or succumbing in anxiety. Whoever has learned to be anxious in the right way has learned the ultimate. Whoever has learned to be anxious in the right way has learned the ultimate. Anxiety is freedom's possibility. And one more sentence. Whoever is educated by anxiety is educated by possibility. And only he who is educated by possibility is educated according to his infinitude. Again, whoever is educated by anxiety is educated by possibility. And only he who is educated by possibility is educated according to his infinitude. Therefore, possibility is the weightiest of all categories. In other words, what's called the boundlessness of one's existence. Tapping into infinity is the possibility of creating your own narrative. Sartre, Jean-Paul Sartre, another great existentialist, who very much took up where Kierkegaard left off, he wrote all about this dizziness, what he called nausea. And one of Sartre's most famous plays is a play called No Exit. You ever see it? It's a crazy, disturbing play. Essentially what it is three people that hate each other, that are in a room together, and then they find out that that's what hell is. That they're for all eternity in a room, just the three of them. This man and two women, they're stuck in a room together for all eternity. That you could think that would be pretty hellish. Right. I was going to say, there's some people, if you can imagine, like you want to pick what hell is, and like pick two people that you can't send, and then imagine being with them for all eternity. But Sartre goes this whole play about that. And the point that Sartre is making, that's where there's the famous phrase that the protagonist says at the end. He says, hell is other people. That I always thought that there were torments and fire and in the end, hell is other people. Now, what does Sartre mean that hell is other people? Again, he doesn't just mean family or whatever, people that annoy you. What does he mean, hell is other people? He means that when your existence becomes stolen by another and you become reduced to the status of an object in an other's world. How many times do we live life because what the other is going to say about us? How many times do we give our own narrative, we define ourselves, we make choices based on what the other, we have what Sartre calls inauthenticity or bad faith, and we choose to define ourselves based on what other people say about us. And how often do we have the ability to choose our own self? That dizziness, the anxiety of the possibility of possibility, and therefore we fall into despair, and despair of having to, of just sort of go with the flow. Freedom means having the choice of possibility, being in touch with one's own infinitude. Now that's very difficult. That's very difficult. It causes anguish. It causes the fact that one has to always be defining oneself and being able to make choices to decide what oneself is going to be. But Rav Kook says, what Rav Kook is trying to say is that if you're willing to constantly try to transcend any definition, you understand that only the only freedom there really is being able to transcend that and being able to have a possibility and create oneself here and now. Now I'm gonna decide how am I gonna connect to God now. In other words, the most beautiful part of Hasidic philosophy or mystical philosophy that Rav Kook is talking about, and we learned about from Chabad, is the idea of the right side and the left side, that the water is on my right and my left. Is that life is about tumultuous waves going back and forth and me having to choose and all the time. But if you understand that that's what redemption is, going through the Red Sea of having the water on the right and my left, having all sorts of circumstances in life and all different types of here's and now's, and saying, and now I'm going to define and choose how I'm going to serve God in this way, that's what it means to be authentic. That's what the existentialists called living in a state of anxiety, but good anxiety. That's what it means to live in a state of good anxiety by always having to choose and define how I'm going to serve God in this circumstance and connect to God in this way, in this place. That's tapping into God's truth and infinity. I want to read you a quote from Rollo May. This is from his book, The Meaning of Anxiety. Listen, this will change the way you look at the word anxiety. We can understand Kierkegaard's idea on anxiety only by emphasizing that he is always speaking of anxiety in relation to creativity. Because it is possible to create, creating oneself, willing to be oneself, as well as creating in all the innumerable daily activities, one has anxiety. One would have no anxiety. I have to tell you, by the way, I know you saw what Elizabeth was doing yesterday over here with the art thing, right? So personally, I get anxiety from modern art. Probably very much connected to this. So when I stood there yesterday, just a couple of moments, and Elizabeth was, you know, she gave me this thing that said what you're supposed to do. I don't remember, you remember the wording? Like
seed.
A seed, or your own seed,
well,
your own journey in life, and write and like paint it. I was inauthentic, I guess. I despaired. I didn't know what to do. Like, I'm like, what am I supposed to do? There's this infinite choice, and she just said, you know, there's no right way, and that disturbed me. Because I was in a state of despair. What?
How is you not knowing inauthentic? Can there be authenticity and not knowing?
I mean, I guess. I thank you for that.
That's what I do. I do what she does.
I appreciate
so
that.
I'm one of those. But I mean, can't there be authenticity in owning that which you are uncomfortable with, and that which you that can be authentic?
You didn't paint the.
What? You didn't paint? No. You didn't try?
I didn't try.
That's so authentic. I mean, yeah.
I hear you. Okay, listen, we could discuss that. I appreciate that vote of confidence. But certainly what Rollo May is saying is that all creativity comes from this anxiety. Let me read further. What one would have no anxiety if there were no possibility whatever. By the way, yesterday was the Yahrzeit, the 400th Yahrzeit of Shakespeare. April 25th, 2016, it was the 400th year to Shakespeare. And you know, one of the greatest things ever written in the history of the world was Hamlet, which is a whole entire play about anxiety. And what was the anxiety of Hamlet all about? Possibility. Well, to be or not to be is one of the choices he had to make, whether to kill Claudius or not, right? Whether to continue his love with Ophelia or not. By the way, parenthetically... I'm sorry?
How is he going to be a vessel of truth in the midst of crime?
That's right. A vessel. Shall he have the courage to be a vessel of truth? That's right. And that might be why the most mysterious words in Hamlet are the last words after as he's dying. Remember the last words that Hamlet said before he dies? The rest is silence. Right? That's silent. Nobody really, everyone's trying to interpret, what does that mean? The rest is silence. But of course, that could be that anxiety that he had to deal with, that silence that you can't communicate to other people. By the way, parenthetically, there's a beautiful essay by Denis Derish Chaffort, something or the other, Regimant, I don't know how to pronounce it in French, called Love and Other Essays, where he has a whole essay comparing Hamlet and Kierkegaard. The two melancholy Danish princes, where there's so much they have in common, this concept of anxiety that you have as creativity. Let me finish the quote from Rollo May. One would have no anxiety if there was no possibility whatever. Now creating, actualizing one's possibilities. Oh, wait, listen to this. Always involves negative as well as positive aspects. It always involves destroying the status quo. Do the 10 plagues strike you as a possibility of connecting to this? Right? The 10 plagues, maybe that's a deeper meaning of what the 10 plagues are. It involves destroying the status quo, destroying old patterns within oneself, progressively destroying what one has clung to from childhood on, and creating new and original forms and ways of living. If one does not do this, one is refusing to grow, refusing to avail himself of his possibilities. One is shirking his responsibility to himself. Hence, refusal to actualize one's possibilities brings guilt towards oneself, or what Kierkegaard called despair. Thus, every experience of creativity has its own potentiality of aggression or denial towards other persons in one's environment or established patterns within oneself. In other words, like Sartre is saying, being able to be true to yourself means sometimes being aggressive to other people. Not aggressive necessarily in a violent way or like necessarily being Israeli or something. Like, you know, that doesn't mean... What he means to be aggressive, he means to say that you have to define yourself and not pay attention to what other people are thinking. Right? That's why, by the way, Israelis are all like that. They don't care what other people think. If the Israelis cared what other people think, they would shut down the state about 30 years ago. Right? Because that's the anxiety that what it means to live in the land of Israel today. The anxiety of living in the land of Israel today is always choosing our own identity, not caring what, not going in other people's narratives. To put the matter figuratively, in every experience of, listen to this, in every experience of creativity, something in the past is killed, that something new in the present may be born. Hence, for Kierkegaard, despair is always the opposite of anxiety. Both are aspects of experience and actualizing possibility. The more creative the person, the more anxiety and guilt are potentially present. One more quote to put this in perspective, the way the existentialists look at anxiety, the anxiety of freedom. So Sartre and Kierkegaard very much believed in this anxiety and nausea and held that that's what it means to define one's existence. That's why it's called existentialism, that existence precedes essence, that one has to constantly be defining their existence and trying to come into touch with how I'm going to create what it means to be me in the here and now, which Rav Kook would call truth of God. But there was one philosopher that at least seemed to be very against this, though it's a question whether he is or not, and that's Dostoevsky. Dostoevsky, in one of his most famous passages, The Grand Inquisitor, from the Brothers Karamazov. So you remember the story of The Grand Inquisitor, is where Ivan is saying this narrative where Jesus appears in Spain in the 16th century, when they were having the Inquisition, the 15th century, and Jesus himself shows up to, I think it was Seville in Spain, where the Grand Inquisitor was having the Inquisition, and the Grand Inquisitor, the Inquisition actually arrests Jesus and puts him on trial. And that's the irony of this story. And essentially what happens is that the way Ivan, who is the atheist brother, is saying to Alyosha, is that Jesus is eventually damned by the Inquisitor. Why? Listen, this is what the Grand Inquisitor is saying to Jesus. Did you forget that man prefers peace and even death to freedom of choice and the knowledge of good and evil? He's angry with Jesus, or we would say as Jews, Lahavdil, we would say God, that it's what we're angry at God, that we're angry at God, why did you give us free choice? Why did you give us that the tree of knowledge of good and evil? We could say it was Adam's fault, however you would like to say it, whichever particular school of thought you'd like to subscribe to, whether it was Adam's fault or Eve's fault or God's fault, Jesus' fault, whatever it is. The bottom line is that did you forget that man prefers peace and even death to freedom of choice and the knowledge of good and evil? Nothing is more seductive for man than his freedom of conscience, but nothing is a greater cause of suffering. Nothing is more seductive for man than his freedom of conscience, but nothing is a greater cause of suffering. And behold, the Inquisitor says, instead of giving a firm foundation for setting the conscience of man at rest forever, you choose all that is exceptional, vague, and enigmatic. You, God, remain enigmatic. You chose what was utterly beyond the strength of men, acting as though you did not love them at all. How? You who did come to give that light, your life for them. And how did you do that? Taking possession of men's freedom, you increased it, and you burdened the spiritual kingdom of mankind with suffering forever. You desired man's free love, that he should follow you freely. Well, that's why God gave a free choice, that we should follow him freely. Enticed and taken captive by thee. Listen again. You desired man's free love, that he should follow you freely, enticed and taken captive by you. In place of the rigid law, man must hereafter with free heart decide for himself what is good and what is evil, having only your image before him as your guide. And therefore, that's the fact that now we have to choose. Our conscience is not at free. We have to choose how to follow God. And I saw a woman on a blog. She wrote a beautiful take on this Grand Inquisitor. Quote, enticed and taken captive by you. That God wants us to be enticed and taken captive. That we should elect, we should choose God. And she writes as follows. And my heart is stabbed alive. Will I make this choice? Will I bear the great daily work of belief in a love that I can't yet see? Will I live as devoted for my invisible God as I would for a human authority? Will I make the difficult daily choice of weighing good and evil, of choosing the right, of walking the difficult, confusing road of righteousness? Isn't that crazy? That's why freedom is scary. Freedom is a responsibility. Yetzias Mitzrayim was the beginning, the exodus from Egypt. Mashiach is the end of the road. And that whole long road from Egypt till the Messiah is this. Will I make the difficult daily choice of weighing good and evil, choosing the right of walking the difficult, confusing road of righteousness? Freedom is a burden. It's a good burden, but it's a burden. The fury of the Grand Inquisitor, sometimes my own, when I wish that the loving God were a simple formulaic thing. Wouldn't it be nice if God was like, you could put him in a box, you know, and put nice, you know, clear paper. As a rabbi, often I'm asked by people, why does God make it so difficult? Why is it so hard? And these questions are all I could say is shake my head, you're right, and I could relate and empathize. But the answer is because that's how God wants us to be authentic, to have that freedom. But sometimes we are angry at God. We wish that the loving of God were a simple formulaic thing. When I wish that choices were written in black and white, that right was a box I could check off instead of a road I must walk. A love I must wrestle. To love in relationships that are difficult requires much more of a laying down of myself than to cut someone off when they went above a certain level of reasonable tolerance. It's much easier to cut someone off in a relationship than have to wrestle with and work on that relationship. But sometimes it's inauthentic to cut someone off. It's inauthentic to say, it's too hard to be in a relationship, let me cut off the possibility. One has to wrestle for it, but that's freedom. It would be easier if there was a list of the right books to read and the right things to do, and I could just check them off and be good instead of daily searching the depths of my soul to find what light or darkness dwells there. And yet, with free heart, I choose this love of God. I choose the work of faith, the great burden of freedom, by living God's love instead of a law that kills the great freedom of love. I choose what it means to serve Hashem. And that's what Rav Kook is saying, expanses divine my soul craves, in the daily here and now. To live in such a way, where can I serve God? How? Choose to serve Him here and now, in this way. That's what Judaism is about. That's what Mashiach is about. That's what all the mystics and the Hasidic masters were teaching us. That's the burden of freedom, the pleasure of freedom, the sweetness of freedom. And that's the truth of God, of being able to find Him always in every circumstance. And that's how I leave the Egypt of myself. If myself has certain habits and different things and different circumstances and different, a whole checklist of this is how I could be, this is how I could be, that's being in the worst Egypt. Leaving the Egypt of oneself means choosing to be in anxiety. Choosing to not burden and cage myself in a particular mode of being, but being open to the constant here and now. The right and the left, no matter what type of way of serving God is before me, seizing that day. The culmination of that would be, and we live in such a way, we're going to see Mashiach come, and we're going to see how in every one of our here and nows was God Himself. We should see it today, Mitzvah Shem. Questions, huh? No, keep the sheets, please. Please keep the sheets and look at them. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
understand more than I should know about this.
Well, I'm not a writer, but I could ask my wife to do it. Yeah. That's what Heschel said. Heschel said that a rabbi's job is to comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable. So the Rambam was the guide of the perplexed, and the Hasidic masters are out to perplex those that feel guided. Yes, the Kutimran is in English. Yeah, you could get it online. Yeah, yes.